My great fortune and honor to be with all of you this evening. My very special heartfelt gratitude to the Gupta family, especially Govind, Jagadamba, Satish and Maya, Dinesh and Priya, your children, Mufatlal, to my very dear friend, Mr. Malhotra, Mr. Niranjan Pandya, Mr. Kishore Vora, Ms. Agarwal, and to all of you. Was it Abhishek that read that introduction? And it was written by Satish. I told Satish that what he wrote was much better than the book itself. The journey home, as I write after the story, in the author's note, it was a book I never wanted to write. Over the years since 1972, when I would tell some stories about my travels and meetings with different holy people, and unholy people also, people would say, you should write a book. And I had a standard answer. I will never write such a book. And I kept to that for almost 40 years. But then one of my dear friends, who was like a brother to me for many decades, His Holiness Bhakti Tirtha Swami Maharaj. He was on his deathbed in his last weeks. He had cancer. I went to visit him for one day, and he requested that, please stay with me. I want to die in your arms. And he told me he had only 3 days to live. So I promised him I would stay with him. But then he lived another 8 weeks. But what a beautiful experience that was. I can never express enough gratitude to him and to be my beloved Lord Krishna for giving me that experience. We didn't know how long he would live. It seemed like within a day, every day. And we made an agreement. When I would come in to be with him, we would only speak about those spiritual subjects that would bring us closer to our God, Krishna. We wouldn't waste a single moment or a single word on any other subject. And we all know how many subjects there are in this world to speak about. Each day when we would meet, I would read a particular verse from Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita, spoken by Madhavendra Puri, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's guru's guru. When he was on his deathbed, he was praying, O Lord of Mathura, O Krishna, I am feeling so brokenhearted in separation from you. Please tell me, what should I do? this vipralamba bhav, this feeling of separation from God, in deep humility, yearning and longing for the presence of God, is explained by Vaishnavacharyas to be the deepest union with the Lord. Union in separation. So after reading this verse, we would have our discussions. We would tell our realizations of the teachings of the Gita, the Bhagavat, our realizations of all our long decades of doing seva. We would especially speak leelas of Sri Ram, of Sri Krishna, of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, of the various avatars, of the various great religions of the world. We would share our deep concern for the people of the world who are bereft of this spiritual wisdom. We would cry, we would laugh, we would embrace. I never could understand. Theoretically, I understood. But wisdom is an experience of the heart that's much deeper than any theoretical knowledge. How much deep honor, respect, and love there could be between two human beings on a spiritual level, as when two people really dedicate themselves in the union of their shared love for Krishna, for God. It was actually beautiful. One day, his cancer was so severe. There was pain that went so deep, right to the core of his bones. And his whole body, which was already emaciated and covered with tumors, was trembling. And we sat him on a chair, and I was in a chair in front of him, and I was speaking some leelas. And I could see the trembling of his body. He couldn't focus his mind on the leelas. So I just held his hand and chanted this Maha Mantra. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. And he was saying it together with me. After about 2 minutes of just chanting this Maha Mantra together, his body was still trembling. He smiled, a brilliant smile, an effulgent smile. His eyes glistened, and tears, not of pain, because in all those months that I was with him, I never saw him cry in pain. Tears of ecstasy poured from his eyes. And he gripped my hand and said, "It doesn't get any better than this." And he said, "We are there." He said, "We are together with Krishna. It doesn't get any better than this. At this moment, I am tasting the sweetness of Krishna in his name in such a way that I would not trade my condition for anyone else's in the world." And he was serious. What is real happiness? Here was a person who was about to die, who was in a type of pain that is beyond human comprehension. And he was honestly, genuinely saying, "It doesn't get any better than this." In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna tells, real intelligence, wisdom, is when we rejoice within, when our happiness is within, when our enlightenment is within. Apuryamanam achala pratishtam, the Gita says. When one tastes love for Krishna, love for God, that experience of happiness is like an ocean. Rivers enter the ocean into this world. Sometimes in the rainy season, the rivers are miles wide. And in the dry season, sometimes there's not even any water flowing into the ocean from the river. But the river, because of its own depth, is not affected either way by either the monsoon rivers or the summer rivers. And in the same way, the experiences of happiness, distress, honor, dishonor, victory, defeat, health, disease, birth, death, pleasure, pain, they are always changing in this world. But the Gita tells us, when we experience that ananda, that deep love for Krishna, and we're experiencing Krishna's love ourselves, that infinite sweet love, that is such an experience that it's beyond the pleasures and the pains of this world. And nahanyate hanyamane sadide, it is beyond even death. One day, this friend of mine, Bhakti Tirtha Swami, he was laying in his bed and I was sitting on a chair next to him. And he held my hand and said, "You should write a book about your travels when you were a young man." And I gave him my standard answer, "I will never write such a book." He said, "Why?" I said, "Wouldn't it be an act of arrogance to write a book all about me? Every page is I, me, mine, I, me, mine. And besides that, if I tell the truth, I really don't think anyone will believe me." He said, "Your arrogance is you think this is your story. This is not your story. This is God's story. It's the story about how God took a young person who was seeking essentially the same thing everyone in this world is seeking. Meaning, love, real happiness. And how he took you through so many challenges." He said, "This book is beyond sectarian conceptions. It could help so many people to find themselves. If you don't write it, that is an act of arrogance. Promise me that you will write this book and publish it." What could I say? I promised. And then he looked at me and smiled. And with great gravity, he said, "You cannot tell a lie to a man on his deathbed." So I decided when I left the room, I'm going to convince him to release me from this promise. But before I could do that, Krishna took him. So in his honor, I wrote this book, The Journey Home. My hope in writing it in the spirit of a servant, just to share personal experiences that hopefully could help people on various levels to understand what a beautiful gift there is in each and every one of us. In the world today, there's so much depression. There's so much intoxication. There's so much infatuation towards sensual pleasures, towards fashions. People are groping to find pleasure and meaning in their life, in so many things. Things could give some degree of flickering pleasure to the body, senses, and to the mind. But things could never give even a drop of fulfillment to the heart. Because the nature of the heart is it yearns for love. To love and to feel loved is the only pleasure of the heart. If we have that, we have everything. If we have everything else, that's wonderful. And if we don't, it's still wonderful. Bhaktivinoda Thakur prayed, Grihe tako vane tako, sadahari pole tako, suke duke pulo nako vadane harinam korore, kai kora madhu sware. Now, whether we are householders living in a beautiful home with a wonderful family, doing our business or our work, or whether we're swamis or babas living in the forest, that's a detail. If we chant God's holy names and tap into that love that is the very nature of the soul, we can find true fulfillment. The treasure within. This is a universal principle. In the Bible, Lord Jesus tells, in this world, all the treasures that you're seeking will be either stolen by thieves, rusted by rust, or eaten by moths. But in the kingdom of God, the treasure is unlimited and it is permanent. And that kingdom of God is within each and every one of us. The journey home is a very special, unique journey for all of us. It's the journey of finding ourself, realizing the source of consciousness, the Atma, who is our true essence. That is Satchidananda, eternal, full of knowledge and full of happiness. To find ourself there. Aham Bija Pratapita. Krishna tells in the Gita, I am the supreme father and mother of all beings. When we experience the love of Krishna, which is forever, God never stops loving us. Sri Radha is the potency of Krishna's love, which is infinite and all-pervading. If only we tune into that love, we are nourished with indescribable happiness, and we become an instrument of that love in everything we do. That connection is our greatest potential. That comfort is our real home within. And for all of us, directly or indirectly, we are all on this journey home. And yada yada hi dharmasya glanir bhavati bharata. The Supreme Absolute Truth, Parabrahman, descends into this world again and again and again to remind us where our real home is. And he empowers his loving devotees to assist him in reminding all of us of the real treasure that we're seeking. I was asked to speak some story from the journey home, so may I do so? Thank you. Earlier this year, with about 5,000 other devotees, I went on a pilgrimage to Jagannath Puri Dham for the Rath Yatra. Very thoughtful, Satish, thank you. Now, we thought 5,000 people is a lot. But when we came to the street and Jagannath, Baladev, and Subhadra were put on their chariots, according to government this year, I think there was 1.2 million people there. So 5,000, we were just like a little drop in an ocean. But anyways, afterward, I returned to America to visit there for some lectures that I was to give. I got an email. You may be wondering, what do swamis get emails for? Even I wonder that. But anyways, I got a very interesting email from Pune, from two of the brahmacharis in Pune, Ramananda and Sundarvar. If they are here, they could confirm this. And there was an extraordinary story they told. They said they were in Calcutta at Albert Road, and they were going to go to Puri for the Rath Yatra to meet all of us. And they were trying to get a taxi to the Howrah station. And for those of you who have been to Calcutta, you know what it's like getting a taxi. Somehow or other, they got a taxi. And they were speaking in the back seat in English to each other. The taxi driver did not speak English, but he spoke, I believe, in Hindi. And he said, I want to tell you a story. He told a wonderful narration from the Srimad Bhagavat, the story of Gajendra, that elephant who got caught in the jaws of a crocodile in a lake and ultimately was helpless, even though he was such a powerful elephant and he had a beautiful family. Nobody could help him in the water. It's a wonderful story because it teaches whoever we are, however powerful, knowledgeable, wealthy, influential, the world has crocodiles that are going to get us. And ultimately, when he realized he was helpless, he fully took shelter of the Lord. First, he tried to do everything within his own powers to save himself. Then he began to offer prayers that he had learned in a previous life. And Vishnu came and delivered him and brought him back to the spiritual world. So these brahmacharis, this was a first experience for them. Usually they're giving Bhagavad Kathas. And now a taxi driver is giving them Bhagavad Katha. Very nice. So they were very much appreciating. And then he said, would you like to hear an English Bhagavad Katha? Another, a story? He didn't speak English. He said, I'm going to tell you a story about an American boy named Richard. Who crossed the whole world to come to India and ultimately came to the banks of the Ganges, to a little Ram temple in Patna. And he was searching for God. And he met a sadhu. And this sadhu told him that I'm a devotee of Ram, but you're a devotee of Krishna. But you won't believe me. And he stayed with him for some days. And then this sadhu gave him a stick and told him that this stick will protect you from all dangers. And especially when you come to rivers, you will be able to see how deep it is before you cross. The devotees, the brahmacharis, they asked, "Did you read a book called The Journey Home?" And he said he never heard of such a book. He said, "Do you know any other stories about this Richard?" He said, "No." He said, "Well, how do you know this?" He said, "When I was a little boy, a sadhu came to my village and told this story after speaking Ram Lila. And I never forgot it." They said, "What was the name of that sadhu?" He said, "His name was Ram Sevak Swami." So I'd like to tell you a little about Ram Sevak Swami. Actually, before I go into that, I'm going to tell a little more about this taxi driver. When they sent me the email, they gave the taxi driver a journey home. And they took a photo of him, and he had a big mustache. And when I got it, I was giving a seminar on bhakti to about 100 people in upstate New York. And just before the lecture, I read this. So I told the story to all these people because I was really excited. And I showed the photograph of the taxi driver with his big mustache holding the journey home to some of the yoga teachers. And one American lady, who's a very prominent yoga teacher, she said, "He looks like a demon." I said, "No, he's a taxi driver." That's the way a taxi driver. But this, I was just turning 20 years old. And I was living in Himalayas for some time, traveling as a sadhu. And my visa was ending. So I was told, if you go to Nepal, they easily give new visas to India. And from the first day I arrived in Ferozpur, across the border from the no man's land between Pakistan and India, it was a mystical experience. It was a challenge to get into India because I had no money. But when I finally was given entrance, it was night. And I was just walking through fields, and I didn't know anyone, and I didn't know which direction to go. I was just walking. But for the first time in my life, and I'm telling you honestly, I completely felt at home. I felt like I was being embraced by my mother in every tree and every star. As I was traveling to Nepal to get my visa extension, I stopped in Patna. And I slept on the bank of the river Ganga, because that was my favorite place to sleep, on river banks, either forest caves, holy trees, or river banks. They're so nice to sleep under. So I woke up in the morning. I didn't know where I was because I arrived late at night. And it was the collectory ghat. And there was so many people doing their pujas and blowing little horns and singing songs and doing incense and bathing. And I was just kind of looking down at them. And I noticed that there was somebody standing over me on the other side. So I looked up and there was this towering sadhu who had long, long white hair and long white beard and flowing robes. He didn't speak English, but he smiled at me. He was in his 80s. I was 20. And he invited me to come with him. He had a little temple of Ram, Sita, Lakshman, and Hanuman. It was just a stone ancient temple with two walls, and two sides were open to the river. And there was an old man, also in his 80s, who was sitting there having darshan, who spoke perfect English. He was retired. His name was Narayan Prasad. And he introduced me to the sadhu, Ram Sevak Swami, and said, Swamiji is inviting you to live with him. So I said, well, I'm just passing through, but I'm honored to stay here. He was one of the first bhaktas, one who followed bhakti that I ever lived with. In the Himalayas, it was mostly, you know, yogis who were very much into Ashtanga yoga, where I lived in Bodh Gaya, where there was Buddhists, Shivites. This person was a very deep devotee of Ram. And I would watch him as he would do his puja, as he would do his japa. But most of all, he was just so kind to me. He was 80. He was honored as a saint by all the people around. He was a scholar of Vedas. And I was just a lost soul looking for my path in life. And he said, my name is Ram Sevak Swami. He said, Ram Sevak means the servant of Ram. And the greatest service we could do for Ram is to serve Ram's children. And all people are Ram's children. And you are giving me the greatest honor by allowing me to serve you. I was very humbled by that. He's honored to serve me? But he meant it from his heart. This is bhakti. I'm going to tell you a couple stories. I stayed with him. It was just the two of us. And for a few hours every day, Narayan Prasad would come and translate. The rest of the time it was just us, and we didn't speak the same language. He would just smile at me and give me things, and it was so nice. I just loved to watch him. And I would sit on the bank of the Ganga and do my meditations. And one day another sadhu came. He just wore a loincloth, long matted hair that was all curled up on his head. And he would go out begging and then cook for Ram Sevak Swami and me. I'll never forget the first day. He went and got some rice and moong dal and made khichdi. It was just a little clay stove on the floor, and he would crouch down, and he had a little clay pot, and he started a fire, and he cooked the khichdi. And I was accustomed to always being hungry, because that's kind of the life of that kind of sadhu. And when you get prasad, when you get food, it's something very, very appreciated. Sometimes we don't appreciate something unless we don't have it. There were leaf plates. We were sitting on the floor, and this sadhu was serving us the khichdi. I tasted it. It was excruciatingly painful. I was thinking, he added some rice and dal to the chili peppers. There were so many chili peppers, it was hotter than fire. I might be exaggerating, but the experience was, as I was eating it, my mouth was in total pain. My nose was running. The wax in my ears was melting. I felt that every pore of my body was gushing out perspiration. It was unbelievable. It was intolerable. But the custom among sadhus is you have to finish everything on your plate because it's God's food. And there was a lot. And I was eating. And I was suffering. And I was crying my eyes. My only goal in life was to finish that plate. Seriously. I forgot all about my quest for everything else. I just wanted to finish that plate and stop. That was my conception of mukti. And just when I was about to finish, that sadhu came by with a bucket and a ladle and said he wanted to give me more. And I said, nay, nay. And I put my hands over the plate. I said, puran, puran, because I learned some words, which means I'm full, I'm happy, I don't need any more. I said, puran, puran. And he looked at me with a big smile on his face because he didn't understand. He thought I was enjoying it. He smiled and said, tora, tora. I said, puran, puran. He said, tora, tora, puran, puran, tora, tora. And then he poured a huge ladle on my plate. And I started eating it again. And I didn't get used to it. Every mouthful was hotter and more painful than the one before. And I was somehow, I ate it. And he came by with the bucket. Tora, tora. And I said, puran, puran. And he looked at the other. There were actually Ram Sevak Swami and one other sadhu. I was between the two of them. He said from his heart, he said, see how this boy is enjoying my khichdi so much that he's crying in happiness? And they were all eating seconds, thirds, fourths. They were enjoying it like anything. And I prayed. So I was in Ram's temple. So I prayed to Ram. Please save me. And he gave me a thought. Can I tell? He was about to drop the third ladle on my plate. And it was a leaf plate. I immediately crumpled the plate up like... And then he smiled and went on to the next sadhu. And I remember thinking at the time, he is telling everybody that I'm crying out of happiness. So it's nice if he thinks that way. After all, he's a very good sadhu and I'm making him happy by my crying, even though I'm crying for a different reason. And I was thinking sometimes to please people, it takes a sacrifice. That was a little lesson. Now, the previous nights before that, these two sadhus, Ram Sevak Swami and the cook, they would sleep on a big piece of stone and I would sleep on a stone below theirs. And these mosquitoes, they would attack after the sunset. And they were so big and so hungry. They were going zzz, like that. And they were biting so hard, and it was itching so much. And mosquitoes were biting. They were covering my body. I couldn't sleep. I was thinking, this is really suffering. But then I looked over at Ram Sevak Swami and the other sadhu, and the mosquitoes were all over their body, eating, sucking, getting fat. And they were just very happily, peacefully sleeping. And I was thinking, this is some kind of samadhi. I want to become like this someday. Anyways, after eating that khichdi, the next night, not a single mosquito came to bite me. I think my blood was too spicy for them. So it's a good lesson that sometimes the difficulties in life actually are opening the doors for special blessings. And this is wisdom. To transform an apparent curse into a beautiful blessing by gaining wisdom and turning to God with integrity in those challenges that inevitably we all must face. One day I went to the visa office, and there was this elderly gentleman. And in those days, 1971 this was, it was quite disorganized. I asked him for a form to renew my visa. And he looked all around. It took him about a half hour to find the form. And I filled it out and gave him my passport. And he looked at my passport and looked at the form and said, "Impossible. Your visa cannot be extended. It's already about to expire, and this type of visa cannot be extended beyond what it is." I was brokenhearted because I was just beginning my journey. India had become my motherland, my homeland, my spiritual place. I yearned and longed to stay there. And I prayed to God, the one God of all people, of all religions. I prayed to that God, "Please, I want to stay here in this homeland of India." And then I saw behind him on the wall was a photograph of a painting of Ram. And I got an inspiration. I said to him, "Do you know, in the country where I'm from, boys and girls, they have all sorts of affairs, they live with each other, they do all those things without marriage." And he was a very traditional person. He said, "That is terrible, terrible place." And I said, "In the country I'm from, almost everybody eats cows." He said, "Horrible, horrible." And I said, "In the country I'm from, practically no one has ever heard the name Ram." He said, "You should never go back to that place." I said, "I have to unless you give me a visa." He said, "I am a devotee of Ram. I must protect you. I will give you your visa." And he gave me visa. Meanwhile, back at the temple, Ram Sevak Swami's ashram, every day about five or six sadhus would come to read and discuss Valmiki Ramayana and Ramcharitamanas. They would sit and read and speak in Hindi together. I couldn't understand,
But they would sit for 2 to 3 hours. And the emotions that they were revealing were incredible. Sometimes they were rolling in the floor laughing. Sometimes they were pathetically weeping and crying, incessant tears. Sometimes they were trembling in fear and suspense. And I was wondering, what is this story?
And Ram Sevak Swami, he instructed Narayan Prasad to tell him, to tell me what was being said. And I said to Ram Sevak Swami, tell me every single thing that's said. I'm so eager to hear what's affecting these souls like this. And after 2-3 hours of Ramkatha, we sat on the bank of the Ganga together. And I said to Narayan Prasad, tell me everything. He said, I will tell you everything. And he told me a story about how when Krishna was a little baby, his name was Gopal. And his mother, Yashoda, she was churning butter. Especially early in the morning, she was churning herself because Krishna would go to the neighbors' houses to steal butter. So she was thinking, I'm growing the best grass and giving it to the best cows, and with my own motherly love, I'm going to make butter that's so nice that Krishna won't steal from the other Brijavasi gopis. And Krishna came and requested the milk from her own breast. And she was feeding Krishna her milk. And suddenly, the milk that was on a stove started boiling over. So she put little baby Gopal down to take the pot off the stove. In the meanwhile, Gopal, he wanted to teach his mother, you shouldn't make any priorities above me. So he took a little stone meant for grinding spices and he broke the clay pot of yogurt dahi that was being churned. And then he went to another room and climbed on a grinding mortar and started taking butter from a pot that was hanging from ropes from the ceiling and started eating it and calling the Brijabasi monkeys and feeding the monkeys. He was a Ram Bhakta. He told me that in Ram Leela, monkeys helped Ram so much. Hanuman, Sugriva, Angada, Jambavan. He said, but Ram was in exile, so he had nothing to give them in return. So he called those monkeys in Krishna's Leela to feed them butter. And Yashoda Mai came after taking the pot off the stove. She came into the room where Krishna was, and she saw Krishna was gone, and the butter pot was broken, and butter was on the floor. And she went into the next room following Krishna's little buttery footprints. And she had a little stick just to scare Krishna so he would behave nicely. And she saw him looking around very, very carefully, frantically, while he was feeding butter to the monkeys. When Yashoda Mai approached him from behind, he jumped off the grinding mortar and started running, and she was running, and he was running, and ultimately he allowed himself to be caught. Then she took a very beautiful silken rope that's used for the calves during milking the cows. And she went to put it around Krishna, but it was 2 fingers too short. She tied more rope and more rope and more rope, but each time it was the same distance of 2 fingers too short. Soon all the neighbors came and brought all their rope. How is this possible? It's not that Krishna's little waist was growing. It was only this big.
And the ropes were coming meters and meters and meters and meters and kilometers. The rope was such a size, and Krishna's waist was so little. But it was always 2 inches too short. This is achintya shakti, inconceivable nature of the absolute truth. And ultimately seeing her devotion, her love for him, to protect him from mischief, he allowed himself to be tied. And Narayan Prasad told me that this story symbolizes that the rope of Yashoda represents her love, her motherly love. Krishna cannot be bound. The absolute truth, who's the controller of all controllers, nothing is outside of him. He could only be bound by the love from the heart of his devotee. I said, okay, what else? What else was said? He said, that's all. I said, your story was 5 minutes. The katha was 3 hours. He said, no, that story is all we talked. So the next day, I was listening. 3 hours went by. We went to the bank of the Ganga, and I said, tell me everything. He said, I will tell you everything. And he told me the same story of Makkan Chor, Krishna stealing butter, exactly the same way. And I said, what else? He said, that's all we said. I said, it's not. There were so many more things. He said, no, that is all we discussed. The third day, he told me the same story. I started to cry. I said, is it that I'm so unworthy that you can't tell me what you were talking about? You're a devotee of Ram. I was hearing in the katha. I was listening carefully. There was no mention of Gopal or Krishna or Yashoda or Makkan. It was Hanuman and Sugriva and Ram and Lakshman and Sita and Ravana. I heard these names, but I don't know what the stories were. Please tell me. He said, no, we only talked about Krishna stealing butter. I cried. And he was moved by my tears. He said, would you like me to tell you why I'm speaking this story and nothing else? I said, yes. He said, the first day you came here to this ashram, that night, Ram Sevak Swami told me that he had a dream. In the dream, Sri Ram, Ramchandra, son of Dasarath, appeared to him and told him, this little boy that has come to your temple, he's a devotee of Krishna, but he doesn't know it. He thinks he's so many other things. And if you tell him he's a devotee of Krishna, he will not believe you. But someday he's going to live in Vrindavan. As long as he's here, don't tell him about anyone except Krishna. That was Ram telling the Swami. So Narayan Prasad told that Ram Sevak Swami is my guru. He ordered me to tell you about nothing except Krishna. But I'm a devotee of Ram. The only story of Krishna I know nicely is stealing butter. So that's the only thing I'm allowed to tell you. He said, but he told me that you wouldn't believe me if I tell you this. And I said, he is correct. I don't believe you. As I was leaving some weeks later, Ram Sevak Swami wanted to give me something. But he's a sadhu living in this simple temple. He had nothing but his murtis and his beads.
So he looked around for some gift to give me, and he had a branch of a tree that was his walking stick, and he gave that to me. I was so honored. I used to watch him walking with that stick. I started to cry with gratitude. You're giving me your own stick. The stick had no material value whatsoever. Its value was, it was given with the love and blessings of a sadhu. And he became so happy, he started to cry to see that I was appreciating this gift. And his last words to me before I left was, the stick of a sadhu's mercy can protect one from the greatest dangers. And I kept that stick. And 2 days later, when I arrived in some little village in the middle of the night after hitchhiking on a truck's back, the back of a lorry, I was attacked by a pack of mad dogs. I was all alone. And I'm only alive today because I had that stick. He saved my life. And later on, it's a long story, but I was in Pashupatinath. I heard from a sadhu that there is a great pilgrimage in Amarnath, and whoever goes there, all their desires will be fulfilled. And I was my desire was to find my spiritual path, because I was following so many spiritual paths. But which is for me? So I decided I will go to Amarnath. And I was on a third-class train, which was overcrowded and was free, because ticket collectors couldn't get in. It was so crowded. And it was a monsoon rainstorm, and we were trapped in a field for 20 hours. And about 30 hours later, we stopped at a station, and I crawled out a window just to get some water and some fresh air. And the train left without me, and I couldn't get in because it was so crowded. And I had no idea where I was. I asked someone at the platform, "Where am I?" They said, "This is Mathura, Krishna's birthplace. And today is Janmashtami, Krishna's birthday. Let us take you to the Janmasthan to see Krishna's birth." That was at 5 o'clock in the morning. I spent all day at the Janmasthan. And then the sadhus took me to the Dwarkadish temple at Vishramghat for the midnight aarti. And that was quite an experience. And a few days later, I planned to go to Amarnath. I was sleeping on bank of Yamuna in Vrindavan, not far from Madan Mohan Mandir. And I got typhoid fever. I couldn't walk. I was sick. The sickest I've ever been in my life. And I was really thinking, I will die. And somehow or other, a farmer picked me up and put me in an ox cart and took me to a charitable hospital. And they gave me some glucose water for about 10 days. And the doctor, whose name was Dr. Krishna Gopal, he said, "You cannot travel or you will die. You must stay in Vrindavan at least for 1 month." By the end of the month, I realized that what Ram Sevak Swami was saying was true. The culture of bhakti, the concept of radha, of devotion, it wasn't a sectarian conversion. I believed in all true religions. I believed in the oneness of God. But the sweetness of the revelation of Krishna was so deep, it was so wonderful. God's aspect as being so playful, so beautiful, so loving, and giving entrance into such intimate experiences of love with him. The concept of Radha, the compassionate potency of the Absolute, it charmed my heart. And I decided, this is my path. I will never leave Vrindavan for the rest of my life. My journey has brought me home. And later on, and there in Vrindavan, I met my beloved Guru Maharaj, His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, who just came passing through. He had no temple or followers there at the time. And his wisdom, and especially his deep compassion for all, moved my heart so much. I just wanted to assist him in his compassion. And I dedicated my life and accepted him as my guru. And about 9 months later, my visa again ended. And that's a long story, but eventually I had to leave India. And when I returned home after years, I left as a college student, a teenager, who told my parents, I'm just going to Europe for a summer vacation for 2 months and I'll be back to continue college. I came back some years later as a hardcore ascetic, as a sadhu. I didn't have a suitcase. I only had a begging pot and some japa mala and a little bag with some books, Srimad Bhagavat, Ramayana, and Gita, and the Bible. And they were astounded. They didn't know, how are we going to relate to this person? And I was looking at them as, how am I going to relate to them? And I went to their little apartment. I was talking to some of the Gupta family about this a little earlier. They had an apartment in Florida. And it was the first time in years I saw furniture. And I thought, this is Maya. And I told them, I said, this place is Maya. They had television and furniture. And they said, what is Maya? I said, illusion. So I wouldn't sleep inside. I slept on a concrete patio that was coming out of their apartment outside every night. And they couldn't understand where I was coming from or who I was. But as time went on, because of our love as a family, I honored and respected them for who they were. And because they loved me, even though I was so totally different, they tried to understand me. And as time went on, they were sympathetic but bewildered. Does that make sense? They loved me and they were accepting me because I was their son. And I loved them and accepted them because I was parents, but we had two very different ways of life. And after I came back to live in India, Mr. Muffet Lal's brother-in-law, Dr. Desai, Srinathji Das, was visiting Chicago, and he met my father. And my father asked, tell me about yourself. He heard. My father asked, what was your education? He said, I got my master's degree at the University of London. I got my PhD in engineering at University of Pennsylvania, Ivy League school. He told him about his business, huge business. Multi-million-dollar business.
My father said, how long has your family been devotees of Krishna? He said, my mother, Pushti Marg, he was a devotee of Krishna, Srinathji, generation after generation after generation, we've always been devotees of Krishna. My father said, I need to ask you a question. You're a millionaire. My son has not had a bank account since 1969. You're a PhD. My son left college after one semester and went to India. Your family, devotees of Krishna for centuries. My son's coming from a Jewish family. Why are you following him? And Srinathji said, Mr. Desai, you have to come to India to understand. So my father said, let me call my wife. She was in Florida at the time. He got on the phone. He said, we're being invited to India. He said, it's the only way we can understand our son. And then he said, my wife only has one question. Do you have flushing toilets in India? He said, yes, we have very first-class flushing toilets. So they came, and they met this family. They stayed at the house of Rishikesh Mofatlal and Rekha, his wife, and they were treated with such love. Meeting the people of India totally transformed their hearts. To this day, their deepest, most wonderful, heartfelt friends are the people of India. They went home, and all their grandchildren, they would tell my brothers, you have to get them baptized by Radhanath Swami in the name of Krishna. They transformed. I was in Mumbai. Today is the 10th anniversary of the passing away of my mother. I request you to kindly pray for her soul. I was in Mumbai on this day, 10 years ago today, when I got the news. And I went back to Chicago for the last rites. The family, before I even came, they decided to do something that was never done in the history of our family, to cremate my mother's body and to give the ashes to me to bring to India, because she loved what I was doing and she loved the people of India so much. That's where she wants to be. And they saved the body for me to come, and I offered some special prayers and pujas. And with over 2,000 devotees on the bank of the Ganges in Mayapur Dham, chanting beautiful prayers and mantras, I offered my physical mother's body into my spiritual mother Ganga's beautiful, gracious current of grace. And half the ashes I put in the Yamuna at Keshigat in Vrindavan. Transformation. Real transformation of the heart doesn't come through forced conversions. Real transformation is the natural awakening of love. These are a few stories of my own little journey home, and I'm so grateful to all of you
for being so patient to allow me to speak them. Thank you very much.
First of all, I would like to thank Swamiji for sharing with us. And if anybody has any questions that they would like to ask Swamiji, they are welcome to do so. Thank you.
Kindly raise your hand and we'll send the mic across to you.
Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna, Radhanath Maharaj. Thank you so much. I had this wonderful opportunity of reading your book, The Journey Home. And I've read that you went through a lot of experiences. You met a lot of Babas. You met Shivaites. You met. You practically went through all the religions, right? You experienced all the religions. My question is, what made you choose Krishna or Krishna consciousness? And there were several people who wanted to become your guru, but you finally chose Srila Prabhupada as your guru. So being going through all those religions and then accepting Srila Prabhupada or Krishna consciousness. So if you could please let us know, it would be great. Thank you.
Your touch, it became surcharged with energy. As I spoke a few minutes ago, I never felt I was converted. In my own way, I was seeking the essence of all religions. Srila Prabhupada taught a beautiful verse from the Bhagavad Purana. Savai pung sang paro dharmo yato bhakti radhokshaje ahoitiki aprati hata yagatma supraseedati. The supreme dharma for all humanity and all religions is to awaken that potential within us to serve God with love. Such service must be unmotivated by any selfishness or egoism and uninterrupted by any challenge, temptation, or obstacle. Only that love will satisfy the soul, because that is the nature of the soul. And in Vrindavan and in Krishna and Sri Radha, in the path of bhakti, I found such a sweet revelation of that essence. When Srila Prabhupada explained the philosophy of Gita and Bhagavat and Upanishads, it seemed to include all the other religious philosophies that I had ever heard. And it charmed my heart. I didn't actually decide to choose this path. I just found I had such faith. I wanted to surrender so deeply. I didn't find Krishna. It's like Krishna found me. And I was so happy. And I wanted to share this wonderful joy with whoever I could share it with. Does that answer your question? Thank you. The nature of the mind is it goes so many places, like a little monkey, sometimes like a big monkey. We all have that experience. So the mind tells so many things. But ultimately, when I dedicated my heart in the service of my guru, when I dedicated my heart in the service of humanity on this path, that was, and it is, such a deep experience. There have been many challenges. There have been many texts. There has been many obstacles. There have been many regrets of things that I've said and things that I've done. But I honestly cannot ever remember that I regret that I've taken to this path in the service of my Guru Krishna and humanity. It's a wonderful path. With whatever shortcomings I may have, I feel deeply honored and grateful that I've been given a chance to serve in this way.
I would like to know that from the way you have spoken and also your book, your audios on the internet, that there seems to be a psychological journey, a permanent psychological journey. But shouldn't one be coming out of the psychological journey, that stratum, and go up to the Atma, which is devoid of psychological traps? But this journey seems to be totally on a psychological path. How does one get out of that?
My guru and Krishna in Vrindavan completely conquered my heart beyond psychological considerations. But in order to communicate with language, it's necessary that we explain how we've come to certain realizations.
स्वामी जी को शशत प्रणाम. एक प्रश्न था, ईश्वर को पाने के लिए साधु बनना जरूरी है?
तिथिक्सव कोरोना का सूर्यदा सर्वभूतनाम अचात सत्रवासंता साधुनाम Bhushanam. The Bhagavad explains what a sadhu is. A sadhu is not simply the way we wear our hair or the dress that we take. A sadhu is one who actually takes shelter of the One Supreme Lord. One who has tolerance, forgiveness, one who finds peace and love within themselves, one who is the friend of all living beings, one who sees every living being as a loving child of God. That is a sadhu. In the Bhagavad Purana, Durvas Muni wanted to punish Ambarish Maharaj. Ambarish Maharaj was a king. He had a wife. He had children. He had the responsibilities of ruling a state. And Durvas Muni learned that Ambarish Maharaj is a greater sadhu than me. Even though Durvas Muni was a homeless person with 60,000 disciples in all sorts of mystic yogic cities, Ambarish didn't have any of those. He was just a humble, loving devotee of the Lord. So one could be a sadhu as a businessman or businesswoman, as a mother, as a father, as a teacher, as an engineer, as an accountant. As an industrialist, one could be an enlightened sadhu in any of these spheres. It's not a matter of changing our occupation. It's a matter of changing our heart. And one can also be a sadhu as a swami. All these different ashrams are there so that we all work together for the betterment of the whole human society. Does that answer your question? I recited that beautiful song of Bhaktivinod Thakur. Whether one is a householder living at home in one's business or whether one is a swami living in the forest, if we sincerely take the name of God, if we sincerely chant Krishna's names, we can experience that love, that happiness that is beyond all the pleasures and pains of this world. That is a saint. That is a sadhu. Bhaktivinod Thakur, who wrote that song, he had 10 children. His wife, Bhagavati, was a pure saint. And he was a pure saint. Under the British rule in India in the 19th century, he was a magistrate. He was a judge in the British courts. And the British recognized that he was the most efficient judge practically in the whole land of India, so that he could judge more cases. They built a railway line from his house to the courthouse. And in the most difficult cases in various parts of Bengal and Orissa, they would station him on special missions because in his occupation, he was so efficient, proficient, but yet he had such compassion. He had such love of God. When he wasn't working in the courthouse, he was writing the most beautiful books, dozens of books that are honored and worshipped even today as some of the greatest philosophical presentations of Dharma and Bhakti. He wrote thousands of beautiful prayers that millions of people every day sing every day to this day. And one of his 10 sons, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, it is his disappearance day today. We celebrated this morning. Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur was a swami. He was a genius, and he spread bhakti in such a way that tens and thousands of people became his disciples. And one of those disciples was my own beloved Guru Maharaj, Srila Prabhupada. And Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, my param guru, my guru's guru, he always said that my life is simply to spread the mission of Bhaktivinod Thakur. He was a swami spreading the mission of a person with 10 children and a wife. Because it was the mission of pure, unalloyed love. Sadhu is a state of heart, not a role in society alone. But our role in society should be in harmony with that state of unalloyed devotion, compassion. That is a sadhu, that is a saint. One more question, please.
Hare Krishna.
No, no, she's been waiting. You have to go. Please. Because I can't see anyone else because the light is so bright. Haribo, Mr. Malhotraji. I'm so deeply honored and grateful. Mr. Malhotra was a very dear friend of my Guru Maharaj, Srila Prabhupada. In fact, he hosted him in Mahabaleshwar in Pune and has been our well-wisher for many decades. Thank you for being with us tonight.
Wow, I get to hold your mic. My gratitude to you. I think it's a big day in my journey to have been able to listen to you today. Very curious question. You said you put your ashes of your mother half in the Ganga and half in the Yamuna. So why did you choose to do that? I know it's very difficult. Different question. I don't know if it's going to help the rest, but it came to mind that I'd asked you.
I get to use your microphone. Thank you. I followed my heart because Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, we believe, is Krishna who has come in this age of Kali in the mood of Sri Radha to spread prema bhakti through Harinam, through Sankirtan. And he was born in Mayapur on the bank of the Ganga. So these are the two most dear holy places in my life, Sri Navadvip Dham on the bank of the Ganga and Sri Vrindavan Dham on the bank of the Yamuna. And it was my heart to offer the ashes of my mother to Mother Ganga and to Mother Yamuna in these two special holy places. Thank you.